The second case for oral argument this morning is Charles Burghead Appellant versus the State of South Dakota Appellee. For the appellant, Mr. Burghead, we have Jamie Patterson, an attorney from Rapid City. And for the state, we have Mr. Craig Eigsted, an assistant attorney general from Pierre. Ms. Patterson, you may proceed. You have 20 minutes.
May it please the court, Mr. Eichstein. I would like to begin by thanking this court for the opportunity to talk about Charles's case, because the errors that occurred at Charles's trial were profound, pervasive, and prejudicial. I would like to begin with issue one, as discussed in appellant's brief. That issue dealt with the deprivation of Charles's constitutional right to have the government prove each element charged for first-degree manslaughter beyond a reasonable doubt. Instruction 12 deviated from the South Dakota pattern jury instruction and inserted the words "or reckless." That deviation lowered the government's burden and denied Charles his Sixth Amendment right to a jury verdict for first-degree manslaughter and his Fifth Amendment right to due process. Recklessness is the mens rea of second-degree manslaughter, and it is not the mens rea of first-degree manslaughter. Recklessness is nowhere to be found in either the pattern jury instructions for first-degree manslaughter or in the statute for first-degree manslaughter. When a jury instruction either equates or substitutes a lower mens rea with the higher mens rea that is required for the offense, the state has not been forced to meet their burden, and you have a violation of due process and a violation under Sandstrom, as discussed in appellant's brief. I think the confusion arose in this trial because of this court's discussion in the opinion of State v. Mulligan. What happened was the state cited State v. Mulligan in their proposed jury instructions, and the trial court endorsed the insertion of recklessness into the jury instructions at trial. And what is first important to note about State v. Mulligan, Your Honors, is that in State v. Mulligan, the jury was properly instructed on the correct mens rea for first-degree manslaughter, which is intentionality. The jury was not instructed that reckless killing could constitute first-degree manslaughter. What Mulligan discussed is a sufficiency of the evidence, and that is distinct from correctness of the jury instruction.
Well, we said that jury instructions are a committee of the bar's best opinion. They're not clearly binding on us. If it's not part of the pattern, where did this recklessness come from?
Your Honor, I believe in Mulligan, what the court was mentioned when it was talking about recklessness is it was discussing that it's true that recklessness can be a fact or circumstance that can be used to prove the higher degree of intentionality. However, the lower degree of recklessness cannot be equated or substituted for the higher mens rea required in a jury instruction, because to do that denies a defendant his Fifth Amendment right to have the government prove their burden.
All right, you've got the words in the instruction, which you don't like. Did the state, was that part of the state's approach to the case to emphasize recklessness?
Yes, Your Honor. It wasn't only their approach, it became the theme of their case. And they not only cited the term recklessness 21 times in their closing argument, but that was their theme. That was their theme. And they even went so much as to say that recklessness is the mens rea for first-degree manslaughter, and you can't find that mens rea in any other offense. And their theme, Your Honor, was that the recklessness of Charles meant he was guilty of first-degree manslaughter. And, Your Honor, I believe that's a very good question, but we would argue, Your Honor, that the error that occurred in this case was structural, and as such, we don't have to go to a harmless error analysis. And, Your Honor, the reasons that we argue that the error that occurred is structural, I think, can be well stated in 23A.26.7, which states that whenever a crime is distinguished by degrees, a jury, if it convicts an accused, shall find the degree of the crime of which he is guilty and include that finding in its verdict. When there is a reasonable ground of doubt as to which of two or more degrees an accused is guilty, he can be convicted of only the lowest degree. And, Your Honor, this statute makes clear that in offenses such as the homicide offenses in the state of South Dakota, they are differentiated by degrees. And as State v. Garreau, this court stated, that differences of degrees are understood by differences of intent, recklessness being the lowest, mens rea, second-degree manslaughter, intentionality, first-degree manslaughter, depraved mind, second-degree murder, and specific intent, first-degree murder. And what happened in the instruction in Charles's case was that, contrary to the plain and explicit directive of the legislature in 23A.26.7, the trial court, in essence, put in two homicide offenses, reckless and intentional, in one homicide offense, first-degree manslaughter, which is the higher of the two, which goes directly against what 23A.26.7 dictates.
Well, let's talk about the statute itself, because your argument is essentially that it has to be intentional conduct. And therefore it can't be reckless. But I don't see intentional conduct anywhere in 22.16.15. When you, and especially subsection 3, when you look at the offense, how do you divine intentional conduct from the language that says without design to affect death, but by means of a dangerous weapon? There's nothing in those words that suggests you have to have intentional conduct.
There's nothing explicitly in those words. That's correct, Your Honor. However, this court's discussion in the DUI death cases in Schlichlaw and Stettler brought out that you have to have a higher mens rea of intentionality versus recklessness for there to be a distinction in a killing, whether it's with a dangerous weapon. Because in those cases, the issue turns upon how the car is driven. Is it a dangerous weapon? And, Your Honor, there had been, I believe, some confusion over the years, perhaps. But State v. Groh and State v. Woloki, I think, made it very clear that recklessness or second-degree manslaughter is a necessarily lesser-included offense. It's what the legislature says is necessarily lesser-included. And because of that, the differences in the degrees of the homicide are differentiated by their intent. And former Justice Morgan, in the concurring opinion of State v. Gregg, talked about this, about the differences in degrees of mens rea in second-degree manslaughter and first-degree manslaughter. And there has to be a difference, as Your Honors, in the intent, or else a reckless killing with a dangerous weapon would always constitute first-degree manslaughter, which would invalidate what the South Dakota legislature mandated in their 2005 statutory changes, making second-degree manslaughter a necessarily lesser-included.
But that statute, that amendment in 2005 for second-degree manslaughter, isn't the language there any reckless killing that is not first-degree manslaughter?
It is.
So then doesn't that imply that first-degree manslaughter could be a reckless killing?
No, Your Honor. Second-degree manslaughter also says that it's neither murder. It's neither first-degree manslaughter nor murder. And What the codifications did is it codified an elements test that formerly had been discussed in State v. Black. And the elements test is understood under the intent degrees, the hierarchy of the degrees that we've talked about. And what the courts now are instructed to do when either the defendant or the government ask for a lesser included is to employ the factual analysis. And I think a very good case was State v. Woloki, because in that case, it was a killing with a dangerous weapon, a knife. And in that case, this court upheld the trial court's refusal to instruct on the defendant's request for the lesser included of reckless or second-degree manslaughter. And the trial court did not hold that the dangerous weapon precluded the instruction. What the trial court held is under a factual analysis, there were not facts sufficient to instruct on a reckless killing. And, Your Honors, you can have a reckless killing with a dangerous weapon. That goes back to State v. Simmons. In State v. Simmons, a case cited in Appellee's brief, the defendant was originally charged with second-degree murder, and the defendant was ultimately convicted of second-degree manslaughter, and it was a killing with a gun. Your Honors, I think because I have a few minutes, I want to make sure I get to a couple of the other arguments, and I'm sure I'll get back to the mens rea in rebuttal. But I'd like to touch on two more of the appellant's issues, if I could. I would like to talk about the error that occurred in the instruction on justifiable homicide and self-defense. This is only at play if issue one isn't decided, as we argue. But at any rate, I think it's still a very important issue. And I had an opportunity, Your Honors, to listen to the former past oral arguments in other cases. I listened to State v. Cottier, and this court asked the defense counsel in that case a question, which I believe that I can answer in this case. And State v. Cottier discussed an error argument on justifiable homicide and self-defense. In State v. Cottier, this court asked during oral arguments, what were you prevented from arguing? What were you prevented from arguing? And when I heard that, I said, I have to try to answer that to this court, because Charles was prevented from arguing his theory of defense. And in State v. Lamont, State v. Huber, this court has made very clear that a defendant's right to argue their theory of defense is fundamental. It's fundamental. And former justice talked about how a trial court cannot willy-nilly impose their theory of the case during the trial, and that a defendant's theory has to somewhat constrain the trial, because it is a state against the defendant. And Charles's theory was that the killing that occurred at the time, there were a number of felonies being committed upon him. And why that is so significant is that we were prevented from allowing the jury to understand how the same facts that the state was calling punching or hitting or simple assault was any number of felonies, aggravated assault, kidnapping. In fact, during closing arguments, the state, representative for the state, told the jury that this isn't a kidnapping, this is punching. And without an instruction on what kidnapping is, the jury could not understand that, yes, those facts constitute a kidnapping. And as it is well established, it's the state's, the government's burden to prove that the defendant did not act in self-defense. And so when the government is able to argue their theory of the case and not have it challenged or confronted or survive the crucible that the Constitution requires of a defense, we were not able to confront the state's theory of their case, and they, their burden wasn't met, and Charles was denied due process.
Let me ask you this. Instruction 8 I think that was a justifiable homicide. One talked about in attempting, preventing or attempting to prevent an offense. It didn't even say a felony offense or a violent offense. How does that play into the argument that you're making here?
Thank you, Your Honor. Instruction 13 was the instruction, I believe, of justifiable homicide. And in that instruction, Your Honor, it instructed three grounds under which a homicide is justified. First, if it is committed in lawful defense of the self or another, or, and this is where it comes into play, Your Honor, or there is a reasonable ground to apprehend a design to commit a felony upon the defendant, or three, do some great personal injury. And as cited in appellant's brief, the South Dakota legislature has said that if a felony is being committed upon a person, they are justified in using lethal force.
So were there conflicting justifiable homicide instructions given in 8, 9, 10, and 12? Is that what you're saying?
Your Honor, I would submit that the jury instructions were confusing as it pertains to this. Yes, and conflicting certainly would be appropriate. I just want to briefly mention State v. Myland because this court just pronounced its decision in the last few weeks, and I couldn't help but think, because in that case, this court held that fists only can constitute aggravated assault, and the state's theory that in Charles's case was that fists only were employed, although there we argued otherwise. But at any rate, I think it was important for the constitutional requirements for this the jury to be instructed that the evidence the state was calling punch and hitting simple assault could constitute any number of felonies. And not only was the jury not instructed, Your Honors, but Charles was prevented from confronting the lead investigator on this issue. Any time that we attempted either in the state's in the cross of him or we called him in our case in chief, the trial court sustained the government's objection that called for a legal analysis. And then when it came time for jury instructions, the court refused Charles's jury instructions on the very issue that we were prevented from being able to bring out through trial testimony, and the jury had no understanding how they could find a felony as instructed in 13 to rebut the state's theory. And this is not just a rebuttal. The state had to prove that a felony was not being committed, and they even argued it was not kidnapping, but they didn't have to prove it because there was no instruction.
Before you're done, can you talk a little bit about the 404B issue on the July incident?
Yes, thank you. Thank you very much. That was the last issue I was for sure wanting to get to. And the July incident was such a profound and had such a prejudicial effect on the jury in this case because the July incident entailed an incident 6 months prior to the shooting in January. And in that, what happened is the trial court not only permitted testimony on allegations of prior drug possession and gun possession, but they allowed the officer from that incident to testify in court to present pictures of various drug paraphernalia and drugs and to talk about the various kinds of ammunition found in the car that was said to be owned by Charles. And most, in our opinion, shockingly, they permitted the witness, the officer, to get down off the stand and to show the jury two guns that they said that Charles possessed, that being a 10mm and an AK-47.
All right. For what purpose did the court delineate why it was letting that evidence in?
No, Your Honor, and thank you for that question. The trial court did not delineate. It just let it in. And in fact, in none of the 404B in this case did the trial court do any on-the-record analysis as is required by this court. None.
The state, I think in their brief, said the court inherently balanced the probative value and the prejudicial value. Do you agree?
No, Your Honor. Inherently balanced, to be quite honest, I'm not sure what that means. Clearly, this court has said it needs to be on-the-record analysis, and that did not occur. And under State v. Pack, that's a per se abuse of discretion. And briefly on Instruction 12, the one theory the trial court said the gun evidence would come in was to rebut a claim of an accidental shooting, and Instruction 12 said there could be no accidental shooting with the use of a dangerous weapon. Therefore, the jury was left with the gun evidence under no theory of which the trial court even postulated was possible for the gun evidence to come in. And with that, I thank you so much.
Thank you, Ms. Patterson. Mr. Eichstead, you have 20 minutes, sir.
Thank you, Your Honor. And may it please the court. State contends that this is a criminal case involving a killing where the jury was properly instructed, determined the matter, and the facts are such that the case should be affirmed. Now, the first issue that we'd like to talk about is the issue one, whether the instruction deviated from the law by inserting reckless. The state argues that it did not, and that recklessness is an appropriate state of mind for first-degree manslaughter under the facts of this case. That's readily apparent when you look at the definition of second-degree manslaughter, which says that it's any reckless killing that does not amount to either murder or first-degree manslaughter. So if recklessness cannot be a state of mind, then that statute really has no meaning. This court also stated in State versus Mulligan and in three other cases that are cited in that case that under circumstances, first-degree manslaughter can be committed by recklessness and not just from some higher standard. Now, that case, interestingly enough, involved sufficiency of the evidence. And the court said either that with first-degree manslaughter, which is something that's proven not by specific intent, but by general intent. General intent includes doing the act that constitutes the crime or doing it either intentionally or doing it recklessly. Now, in that case, they said, well, there's no recklessness here. So therefore, there needs to be some evidence that will support intent. But the court clearly said that first-degree manslaughter may be committed by reckless conduct, and in addition, cited three other cases that allowed for it.
So what are the facts in this case that made it right to add the words "or recklessly" to that instruction?
We would say that it's the use of a dangerous weapon, because the statute states that if something is done with the appropriate mens rea and it's a dangerous weapon that's used and it's used recklessly, then that's enough for first degree manslaughter. Now, the defendant makes an argument relative to, well, then how would you have a lesser included offense? Well, you don't have a lesser included offense if you use a dangerous weapon. The statute says you use a dangerous weapon, you use it either intentionally or recklessly, and it's first degree manslaughter. Now, perhaps the defendant, if he wanted a second degree manslaughter instruction, would be entitled to it, simply because the statute calls for it. Perhaps not, because the facts wouldn't call for it. But in this instance, if the defendant asked for the second-degree manslaughter instruction, then the jury presumably could convict him of that. But where there's a dangerous weapon involved, and it's a per se dangerous weapon, either recklessness or intentional use of the weapon is sufficient. Now, as far as the the other cases that the defendant cites are concerned, if we go to the Woloki case, for instance, that has little to do with this, because the holding in Woloki was that you could not have a second-degree manslaughter, lesser-included offense instruction, if there was no recklessness shown. But it didn't say that you could never have first-degree manslaughter if there was recklessness. Likewise, Stetter and Siegelaw do not control this case because the issue there was whether a car actually was a dangerous weapon. Well, and in order to be a dangerous weapon, it needed to be used in a manner that would make it a dangerous weapon. That goes to a separate intent of the defendant. But here, that's not the case. A sawed-off shotgun is a dangerous weapon. It's so defined as a matter of law. It can never be otherwise. So that distinguishes Stetter and Siegelaw. Basically, this court has said that a mens rea of either intentionally doing the act that constitutes the offense with no particular specific intent, or doing the act that constitutes the offense recklessly, is enough for first-degree manslaughter in this case. And that case specifically states that, and that's the law in this state, and it comes from this court's cases, not only that case itself, but the ones that it cites. As to the next issue that defendant argues here today, the matter of specifically, excuse me, defining felonies, this court has not required that in a manslaughter case where the issue specifically was self-defense, specifically where the defendant who was in a car and then was attacked with a knife wanted to have specific felonies defined. Defendant was not deprived of anything. Defendant was not deprived of his ability to argue self-defense here. The addition of all of the instructions of whatever felonies defendant thought might have been committed was unnecessary and would have confused the matter to the point that the jury perhaps could not have even understood it. And the court has not required such specific felony instructions in the past. And as I said, Walton specifically states that there's no necessity for it. And as to having the investigator testify, the court appropriately held that testimony on issues of law of that kind is rarely helpful and is ordinarily inadmissible. So, and the main point of this is, though, that the court fully instructed on self-defense. The court fully placed the burden on the state to disprove self-defense. And in particular, the court correctly stated that defendant needed to show that it was necessary for him to use the deadly force. I mean, there's a necessity, there's a requirement because of the nature of human life being particularly valuable and valuable above all things, that before one takes a human life, it needs to be necessary for that person's defense. Whether a felony is involved, some other offense is involved, or something else is involved. And as we pointed out in the brief, the court, however, did say that if the defendant was defending himself against an offense, and later on stated that if he was defending himself against a felony, he could use deadly force, but he could only use deadly force if it was necessary. And that is the key point, and that's what the state disproved in this matter. Not whether he was committing a simple assault, an aggravated assault, a kidnapping, or any number of other felonies. The point was whether this was necessary, absolutely necessary, to use the deadly force in this matter. I'd also like to move on to the matter with the 404B, the other acts evidence. Now, I do need to make an admission. I will state that the state's brief is in error strictly on the issue of whether or not these four incidents were preserved. What actually happened is that the defendant did appropriately object to the July 18th, 2012 incident, which is the main one that's argued here. The defendant did appropriately object to those matters that came, those items that came from the hotel room of Rod Hickey. He did not properly object to the Miranda Brown Bowl matters. In fact, the first time they were offered and admitted, he did not object at all. The second time, he objected to relevance only. And the final of the four matters that were raised in the brief, he did not object to those items that were found in, or he did object to the items that were found in Sabrina Martin's house, but not on 404B, strictly on general relevance. So with that, the state does admit that there was a proper objection to the July 12th, 2012 matters. Now, those are really the only ones, in the state's view, that constitute 404B material. The other matters were either circumstantial proof of the crime itself, or just ordinary evidence, not evidence of other acts, or they were of sufficiently close to constitute res gestae evidence. So really what we're down to is the July 18th incident. That was a different act, and it was an act that the court admitted. Now, the court did not state the specific reasons that it was admitting it at the time that it considered the evidence. It did limit its consideration, however, in instruction number 38, and that said the purposes for which it could be admitted. But the state, in the course of arguing the matter at the pretrial hearing, did argue that it was the July 18, 2012 incident was admitted as common scheme, plan, knowledge of use of guns, and knowledge of use of guns in a drug transaction. And that also relates to the common scheme being to use guns in the course of defending oneself in a drug transaction. And the defendant himself talked about that in his statement. So this is not out of line in the sense with the other evidence that came in. Now,
but Carol, I didn't see any 403 balancing on the record.
There is no explicit balancing. It is our argument that the court, in the course of considering this pretrial hearing, inherently balanced it by making statements of the sort that you're not going to be able to keep this out, and it comes in for these reasons. But it's true, the words balancing and weighing are not present.
What about our cases, though? We've repeatedly said it's got to be done on the record.
Yes, that's accurate, Your Honor. And
so what do we do?
Here I think you look at it, and you can look at it as under the Larson case and some others that we've cited in our brief as not being harmful, not being prejudicial. So it's essentially harmless error.
Well, but the court, we don't know what purpose the court said it could be admitted for, do we? How is the defense supposed to defend if they don't know what the court is allowing it to be used for?
The court didn't specifically state, but the state in the course of offering it said what it was offering it for. So I mean, the defendant knew there what he was defending against.
He hit a shotgun and said everything that's under 404B, as I read it.
Well, I think it was a little bit more limited than that, Your Honor. But they did indeed state why they were offering it, and you know, I think that the point is that the only thing that 404B now prohibits is offering it to show that the defendant had poor character, and the state did not offer it for that purpose. The state offered it, as it stated, for his common scheme, his knowledge of guns, his use of guns in the course of the drug transaction. The defendant himself referred to how he needed to use guns to defend himself in the course of the drug transaction. So
you're suggesting that we look at the record and see and make a prejudice determination.
Yes, I'd say that you do that and determine whether or not it was prejudicial. But as another possible alternative, this court has, in a number of cases where there hasn't been specific statement as to the findings that the court needs to make, the court has sometimes remanded for the findings, so that if the findings are not present, state would argue that the court can also remand and allow for the balancing after the fact.
Well,
go ahead.
The one case I remember we did that, it wasn't the trial, it was whether or not there was prejudice in the selection of the jury. So it was totally separate issue.
And that may well be the case. There are also cases where the court, and I'm thinking specifically of McCafferty and some of them that follow that allow for consideration of those matters that are a prerequisite to the admission of evidence. So the court has done that before. So that's a suggestion of something that might be done here for the to have the balancing put in here. Okay. The state would also then respond to the matter that relates to instruction 12, and that I need to. Okay. And so far as that is concerned, the defendant argues that he wasn't permitted to argue his theory. But the argument here is extensive. It is sufficient. And the defendant argued for a lengthy time, was able to bring out to the jury all theories of defense that he wished to bring out, and was able to argue, and of course the thing that's most important, he was able to argue that he was attacked, which the state did not go against that contention. The state admitted that. The state admits that here. The question that the jury was called upon to decide was appropriately instructed, was appropriately and extensively argued, and that was whether, in the context of what happened at exactly that moment, there was self-defense or there wasn't. Was it necessary for the defendant in this circumstance to use deadly force? And the burden was placed upon the state. The state was required to prove that the defendant did not need to use the deadly force. The state proved that. The jury was appropriately instructed on that. And for those reasons, we would argue that the matter should be affirmed. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Agstead. Ms. Patterson, you have 10 minutes for rebuttal.
Thank you.
During closing arguments, the prosecutor told the jury, "I submit to you, ladies and gentlemen, that by the time your behavior matches up with your description, it is no longer a mask. It has started to be part of who you are. It has started to be what you do. And the mask is really easy because you've just become that person." That, Your Honors, is classic propensity evidence. And the state's use of 404B evidence was not permissible under the rules as has been set out.
I have a question, Ms. Patterson. So there was a formal motion for admission of 404B filed, then an evidentiary hearing at which three witnesses were called. Did the defense ask the trial court to delay ruling on the admissibility of the 404B evidence until the state's rebuttal case? If so, why?
Yes, Your Honor. Charles did, and he did that because this court has stated that's the preference, that's what the court, his preference is to delay admission of 404B until after the state's case in chief. And in particular, with Charles's case, that would have precluded a lot of the errors that occurred because the drug count one, was dismissed. There was no...
Wouldn't that depend on for what the purpose for which the 404B is being offered?
Yes, Your Honor, and the representative for the state just said that at that hearing, the government was saying that the 404B evidence was coming under a course of conduct to prove a drug transaction. And the drug count, the distribution of a controlled substance, to wit, a killing during a felony, to wit, a distribution of a controlled substance, was dismissed properly by the court because there was insufficient evidence to prove up the drug count. And therefore, the 404B evidence was clearly erroneous, and it was prejudicial under a harmless error analysis because the state has not proven that the admission, particularly of the July incident, did not have some effect upon the verdict and were harmful to the substantial rights of the party. They have not proven that. Your Honors, I would also, the state talked about State v. Walton. I'm moving now to the justifiable homicide self-defense issue. State v. Walton was not identical to Charles's case in all fours, as they stated. The key difference was in State v. Walton, as stated in a footnote by this court, it was unclear who started the fight. And that has been conceded by the government in this case, that Marufo and Milk were the first aggressors, that two men pummeled Charles in the car as he sat ambushed. And therefore, as they acknowledged in count three of first-degree manslaughter, a crime was at play. And the deprivation to Charles, what he was deprived from arguing, was that the crime that was occurring was a felony. And the state was able to argue it was hitting, punching, and simple assault, and we were never able to confront that. And that's the clear error that happened to Charles on that point. And the state talks about how in cases that are only talking about self-defense, Your Honor, and I reminded myself of Instruction 8, and that goes, I guess, more in the self-defense kind of instructions. But in the justifiable homicide instruction under State v. Pellegrino and State v. Cottier, this court, the defendant was instructed, the jury was instructed in those cases on felonies, aggravated assault. And Charles requested such an instruction and was deprived from that instruction, and even though the evidence was there to instruct on it. I will, I guess, end with the mens rea, and I would like to talk from State v. Cottier, which in this court says, no court has discretion to give incorrect, misleading, conflicting, or confusing instructions. To do so constitutes reversible error if it is shown not only the instructions were erroneous, but that they were prejudicial. And, Your Honors, this instruction of the insertion of recklessness was clearly erroneous. Again, it goes against the pattern jury instructions. It's not found in the statute. But I would submit that the state's allocution, and I say this respectfully, that the state's allocution in the rebuttal was unworkable. in that they said that in Charles's case, if Charles had asked for a lesser included of recklessness, that he would have been entitled to it. But then there would be no differentiation between the recklessness in the second degree manslaughter and a reckless or intentional in first degree manslaughter. And
I think, didn't the state say they wouldn't be, because there is no reckless manslaughter if a weapon is used? Did I misunderstand? So there isn't an issue of second degree as a lesser included in this case?
There would have been an issue of that, Your Honor, if Charles had requested it, but he did not request a lesser included in this case. Maybe I misheard the state in their rebuttal. I apologize if I did, but what I understood him to say was that. Your Honor, I think State v. Woloki is very illustrative because it's after the statutory changes. It's a case that deals with a killing with a dangerous weapon, a knife versus a gun. And the elements test states that second-degree manslaughter is necessarily a lesser included by statute. The legislature has already taken that off the table. And State v. Gouraud talked about how the homicide offense and the differences in degrees are understood if you understand the differences in degrees of by intent and the hierarchy that we've talked about. So recklessness is the mens rea for second-degree manslaughter and is not the mens rea for first-degree manslaughter, which is intentional. And that has to be the case, or else there would be no difference between the two offenses and would go against the plain language and of 23A26.7 and wouldn't pass constitutional muster if a reckless killing with a dangerous weapon was first-degree manslaughter. It would render moot the codification of the elements test, making second-degree manslaughter a necessarily lesser included. And in State v. Woloki, the court employed the factual analysis test and found there were no facts in that case. The court did not hold what the state is trying to argue, that, and in fact, the state can cite no case, because none exist, where the jury has been instructed that recklessness is a sufficient mens rea for first-degree manslaughter. That's because there would be no difference between the degrees of the crime, and it wouldn't pass constitutional muster. State v. Mulligan, again, is a sufficiency of the evidence issue. And it's true, yes, it's true that recklessness can be circumstantial evidence which can prove intentionality. And that's what this court was talking about in State v. Mulligan and has talked about recently in State v. Bow, that recklessness is a fact or circumstance which can prove intentionality. But if a jury instruction will violate due process and the holding in Sandstrom, if it either equates or substitutes the lower mens rea with the higher mens rea required for the state to meet their burden. And that's what happened in Charles's case. And that's why he was denied his Sixth Amendment right to a jury verdict for first-degree manslaughter and his Fifth Amendment right to due process. And I think the justice asked a question pertaining to a harmless error analysis for the error that occurred with this addition of recklessness. And we submit that the error was structural. But even under a harmless error analysis, Your Honors, the error that occurred was not harmless. The state cannot meet their burden and has not met the burden. Their argument is there's no error, because they know if they concede it's an error, there's no way that they can prove in all probability this error did not produce some effect upon the verdict and was harmful to the substantial rights of the party. And, Your Honors, I have 30 seconds left, so I think that unless you have other questions, I will end with that, and I very much appreciate you listening.
Thank you, Ms. Patterson. The court will be in recess until 11 o'clock.